Good afternoon. I will now call this meeting of the Senate Transportation Committee to order. Let the record reflect that it is 1:31 p.m. on Thursday, January 31st, 2023. Let the record also reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business today. Senator Wilson has other legislative business this afternoon, so he won't be present. Present today are Senator Jesse Keel, Senator Lukey Tobin, Senator Rob Myers, and myself, Chairman James Kaufman. We have any other legislators? Again, they don't know what they're missing. There's no one else here. So staffing the committee today is my Transportation Committee aide, Emma Torkelson, the LIO moderator, Sydney Truitt, and Joanne Crossett from Records. Did I get that pronunciation correct? Great, thank you. At this time, I would like to remind everyone to place your bucket in that your phone in that bucket of hot molten tar that's right back there. If you won't do that, you could at least put it on silent. The opening agenda. Our agenda today is a presentation from the Department of Transportation and Public Facilities on their federal funding, including the next 5 years of IIJA and planning processes for the future. So present today in person is Mr. James Marks, Director of Planning and Development, Adam Moser, Program Development Chief. If you would, please approach and we'll get you on the record. Also available online, not quite yet, but we may have Judy Chapman. She's not quite there online yet. So thank you.
Yeah, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is James Marks. I'm the Director of Planning and Program Development for the Department of Transportation. I am going to be talking through, where we've been and also where we're going. You know, this first year has been really exciting, but also a lot of unknowns. There's been a lot of this, this idea, this fear of missing out. So trying to put as many connections out there to make partners has been a big priority for us so that we can maximize IIJA. And, planning is our bailiwick. So we're going to talk about, what's to come and what type of things we're talking about over the next year and beyond. So you're going to start to see this graphic a lot. Over the last year, we've been really starting to hone in on this idea of continuous improvement, utilizing agile and lean processes to always be looking back at what happened, what went well, what didn't well, and using that to inform how we're planning for the future. So the agenda today is structured in three parts. It's a retrospective, looking back at what's happened over the last year, some lessons learned, what's went well, what hasn't, and in some instances, some candid disclosure. You're going to see the voice of the customer throughout this presentation. We actively solicited from some of our partners, from our RPOs and MPOs, Alaska Municipal League, to say, how are we doing, to try to do that temperature check. So you'll hear some of that. We'll also talk about, planning. If you spend any amount of time with the commissioner, you're going to hear a couple catchphrases. One of them is it all starts in planning. And he's been repeating that regularly with me and my staff. And it's an important point because so much of what we do when we're looking at IIJA is this idea of legacy, not individual, even department legacy, but the import of the decisions that we're making with IIJA and how the future is going to look back on those decisions. So trying to do those in a way that, would be good. So we'll talk about, what's changing within planning to account for some of that, moving towards what's kind of this, we're calling this family of plans, and so as well as some changes that are happening in the world of planning. And then there's this idea of deployment. I think he used this other catchphrase, our commissioner, in your last session, is like, we're doers, and we are. So we're going to talk a little bit about, what's to come, what things are actively in motion that you'll be either seeing about or may have already seen.
Thank you. We just pause for a little bit. From the committee, any questions?
Hello. Thank you so much, Mr. Marks. I just want to ensure that you cover this during your presentation, so I'm going to ask it up front. But I'm really curious of how the department is incorporating land use and also the complete streets, as I know there is a federal percentage, I think it's 2.5% for planning and research. So just within the presentation, I hope that you touch on those. If not, I'll be asking afterwards to just loop back.
That's great. Thanks.
Thank you. Anybody else? Let's proceed.
Great. We gave some presentations this last year. So this one is more of a catch-up for anyone that's not familiar with the Infrastructure Investment and Jobs Act. This shows how the formula funding is coming through. And just for context, what the Department of Transportation state is used to is really just that top line. It's our apportioned programs. Everything underneath of that is a lot of what's new with IIJA. So while we did see some plus ups in some of our existing formula programs, the majority of what we're seeing with IIJA is in new discretionary, new formula programs, but also the number of eligible direct recipients. So in the past, the department has largely been one of the main agencies that's been able to take advantage of these. USDOT has had to go from working with 52 states and some metropolitan organizations to over 60,000 direct recipients. So scalability of this is a challenge. So one of the things we'll talk about later is how do we scale this in a way for the state so that local communities, for regions, for areas that may have an interest in this, can get access to resources. So we'll talk about partnerships with AML and with other agencies trying to expand that support where DOT isn't always in the driver's seat, where maybe we're providing a resource or an engineer or a planner that can help.
Questions? So, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Mr. Marks, I'm looking at, we have Bridge Program, which is a formula thing, and the Bridge Investment Program, which is discretionary, and I'm just curious about how those two interact a little bit, just trying to, you know, avoid reinventing the wheel here, you know, doing the same work twice over.
Right. So these are, it's all part of one package, but they're coming through two different flavors of money, two tranches. So part of it is formula. States get a minimum of $45 million a year, and then it scales up based off of the percent of bridges that they have that are in poor condition. The discretionary piece is ones where we can actually go out and apply for additional funds in addition to that $45 million. So the state did get the standard 45, 225 over 5, but we are also working with communities to identify bridges to bring additional funding through the discretionary program.
Senator Keel.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Marks, thanks for being here. So I think the first completed IJA project in the state was is in our district, at the Grandpa's Farm Bridge in Gustavus. Was that an example then because the community had previously gotten it designed, I think with department help, of a use of formula money, or was that discretionary, and how would I tell the difference?
Very good question. I don't know the answer to that one, but we can certainly get back with you.
Are there hallmarks of the two that a person could get a sense, or is it just going to be got to dig into the documents?
Some of it is digging into the documents. Some of it is, you know, and we'll talk about it a little bit more later, but it's relevant now, is this, you know, idea of, you know, the funding is coming to the state through a lot of different kind of small channels. And how do we go about distributing that funding? You know, we've got our standard community transportation program, transportation alternatives program, but some of this is working its way into new state programs. So later this quarter, we'll be doing like an active solicitation for a community bridge investment program, and that would be utilizing those funds. So to answer your question, it's trying to establish state programs that can be intentional about how we're using these funds.
Thanks.
Go ahead, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am excited to see the Reconnecting Communities pilot program listed here. I know Detroit received some of those first grant funds, and Fairview Community Council, with the assistance of NeighborWorks Alaska, has also applied. And I'm very hopeful that DOT is an integral part of those conversations, as we know that federal highway bisecting that neighborhood is pretty detrimental to community health.
Well, thank you. I have a few questions. In the graphic So there's three stages that I see here, and they're color-coded. If you would, before we go further, would you explain the reasoning behind that?
Yes, sir, Chair. The graphic, you know, was – this is for those who have spent any amount of time in, like, a continuous improvement methodology where you're always looking back, working to incorporate and learn. So this is kind of the hallmark of a learning organization, meaning you're always evaluating what happened, you're looking at what went well, what didn't go well, and you're making adjustments. So this first graphic is that retrospective, where we're looking at what's happened. So this is the descriptive and diagnostic kind of part of that analysis, where we're saying what's happened over the last year, and what worked and what didn't work. Let's maximize what worked and let's fix what didn't. And this could be, we apply this in a lot of different situations, from how we work with communities to how we're developing programs to how we're rolling out funding. A big part that you'll see throughout this and very intentionally at the end is partnerships. And we can't do any of this by ourselves. It's just too big, and the capacity doesn't exist there. And frankly, the administration, the U.S. administration, is much more interested in getting closer to local government. You're going to see that throughout IIJA, that and in the discretionary grant awards that are coming through. So partnering with communities is a big piece. But to your point, Chair, this first graphic represents that retrospective, that thoughtful analysis.
Thank you. So as I look through the presentation, we're on slide 4 now. When we get to 9, we change to planning. So in context, up until we get to slide 9, is this piece of the presentation that learning retrospective in content?
Yes.
Okay. I think that's just good context for the committee. And to that, as I look at this funding overview, one question I had, is it comprehensive? Or it says that it's program examples. So if there's more, what does the real list look like?
We've got a more comprehensive list on a future slide.
Okay. And then the other thing, as far as I'm going to throw another term out at folks, a RACI chart. So that's basically the interface management chart of responsibility, accountability, et cetera. Is there somewhere clarity around who owns all of, you know, the various responsibilities, accountabilities, and who needs to be informed, et cetera, similar to a RACI type chart? Does that exist somewhere?
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question and one that we've been grappling with. You know, as we've been trying to go through this period of rapid expansion, meaning with partners and more, there's a lot of more additional cooks in the kitchen, and trying to identify who needs to be consulted, who needs to be informed, who's responsible, has been one of the challenges that we'll talk about. That idea of who's on first. When we're looking at teaming, bringing a multi-agency interdisciplinary teams together to tackle some of these, getting very prescriptive about who is doing what. And that has been one of the challenges as we've been kind of going through and working in new ways that we haven't worked in before.
Thank you. That I just have to say for myself, as the chair of Senate Transportation, I feel like I have to internalize your cost centers, who's doing what, how they interrelate, and then to their stakeholders. So I know I have asked, and we will be asking a lot more questions, but I'm trying to understand that entire geography so that I can better understand what I'm hearing and where we need to go if we need to go somewhere. So I appreciate it. Thank you.
This gives you a sense of context for the entirety of IIJA, and again, this is just what they call apportioned. So this is our formula programs. So over the life of IIJA, You've probably heard a figure of, $3.5 billion for Alaska over 5 years. This gives you a sense of the high-level tranches that funding comes through. About 48% of it is coming through what they call the National Highways Performance Program. About 26 to 27% comes through surface transportation block grants. The two new that you see there at the end is the carbon reduction, which is really focusing in on greenhouse gas reduction, electrification, removing transportation-related carbon from the system. And then there's the PROTECT formula program, which is really getting into resiliency, resilient from natural disasters, resilient from things like earthquakes and West Coast storms. And resiliency can mean a lot of things to a lot of people. So getting clear definitions on what that is. Some of it is an evaluation of our, we call our twice hit assets. These are things that keep getting hit over and over again. Part of it is also looking forward and what's going to change. We've been in preliminary discussions with UAF and Two Bears on creating a climate atlas for the state, as an example, that can predict out what's going to change with the climate 50 years. And then, in turn, how might that affect some of our transportation infrastructure? So it's that kind of prospective look that we're working in. So you'll see some of that as we go through the slides.
Good question.
Yes, Senator Gill.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ignorant question number. I can't think how many. We've only had our third meeting of the year. Two Bears, did you say? UAF and who is that?
Yeah, I believe they're called Two Bears.
Who is that?
They're a climate advocacy group here in Alaska.
Thank you.
Any other questions? All right, let's proceed.
So the last slide gave you a national snapshot. This slide tells you what's happening within the state, including our current year. So this gives you a sense of scalability. 2021, you'll see a hashed, that is where you're going to see the relief funding, so the CRISA and the ARPA funding. But in total, we're looking at around 28 to 30% growth from previous levels. And one of the important things to recognize with IIJA is it's not a brand new thing. It is a reauthorization of a transportation bill. So this is reauthorizing existing programs and making some new programs. A good portion of this funding we would have received anyways. In the next slide, we'll cover what the delta is between what we would have received and what we're currently receiving. But in general, you're looking at a growth of about $170 to $200 million from the FAST Act legislation. You'll see, I would call out the two yellow boxes. Those represent the fact that we have not received our full year apportionment. The federal omnibus was passed, but once that happens, it has to go through a lot of formulas. So there's usually anywhere from a 6 to 8 week gap between the time the president signs the bill and all of the funds make their way through all of the federal formulas. Our ferry boat funds, for example, we have not received for this year, but we anticipate, around 31 to 33 million. So these numbers that you see in yellow are projected based off of formulas.
Questions? Thank you. Continue.
So this is where we really start to dive into some of the details of how the funding comes to the state and comparing it between what we would have gotten anyways and what we are receiving now. So the first column or the first bar represents inflation-adjusted funding from FY22 through 26 if we had received FAST Act level of funding. So that's what we received everything before IIJA. The expected is what is in the new bill. So a lot of it is growth in existing programs, but some of it is new programs. in the table, we've highlighted a couple areas to call out. So the percent that you see shows the percent of total growth. So $559 million is the total growth of what we would have expected to receive under the FAST Act. We're actively receiving about $3.54 billion over the five-year period. The one thing I would call out that you don't see on here is aviation, and that's because they weren't part of the FAST Act. They actually go through what they just call a reauthorization, and we can provide that in more detail later if you'd like. Of the growth, the $559 million, about 41%, 42% of that is coming in our traditional national highways funding. Transportation alternatives, which has traditionally been a fairly low percentage of overall, saw one of the largest growth over the FAST Act. And part of that is because of the way the bill changed the formula. It went from a 4 to 6% set aside from STBG to 10%. So this is carving out funding out of the surface transportation block grant. And so we're seeing more funding in transportation alternatives. The two new programs, PROTECT and Carbon Reduction, collectively contribute about 34% of the additional growth that we're seeing. So these new programs. Maybe I'll pause there for questions.
Yes, thank you, Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This may seem like another one of those dumb questions, but I know that to leverage these federal funds, we need state match. And I'm assuming that this is all the federal dollars, but will there be subsequent growth that we will need to compensate for within the state system? And if so, where is that delineated, or what do we see what a potential way to maximize these dollars might be for the state?
Yeah, great question. Through the chair, Senator Tobin, this is just the federal. In the capital budget, you will see represented the growth of anticipated match. The part that you would not see is the discretionary grants, because those will be handled on as we are awarded, then that you'll see those come through in the capital budget. But all of that growth you will see in the capital budget, and you would have seen this last year as well, yes.
Any questions? I'm just curious, as far as these categories, marine highway system, is it somewhere in one of these buckets?
Great question, Chair Kaufman. It is not. So these are what are called formula. So there's federally we get apportioned programs, and there's a statute in Title 23 that actually defines what all of this is.
Okay.
There's additional what they call allocated programs that we receive in addition. Those are subject to annual appropriation. So we typically do see those funded year over year, but that happens when they pass the omnibus, the annual appropriation. And then they either are directly allocated, like in the case of emergency funds or congressionally directed spending, or they go through another predefined formula, and the ferry boat funds would be like one of those funds.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Any other questions? Let's proceed.
So this gives you a kind of candid look at what some of our challenges have been over the last year. To Senator Tobin's point, the state is not in a very good position to inform or direct land use. So oftentimes there's this perception of being either disconnected from land use for good reason, and also community and regional needs. We do have planners that try to get out into the regions and some sit in a lot of assembly meetings, but we can't be everywhere all at once. So this is going to start to play into this idea of community-driven planning or community-driven project delivery that we're starting to explore in the department. The idea of this silo mentality in this versus a team mindset.
And this is not just within the department. This is, you know, across the state, whether we're working just with among ourselves or with other partners. This idea of team has been a big push for the commissioner that we've been working to, whether you're looking at the three distinct regions within the department or between divisions of the department. So trying to bring more resources to bear and more minds to the table to evaluate some of these things. A big personal push for me in the division is some of our data practices and our legacy systems. We're dealing with project management systems that are in excess of 40 and 50 years old. Our way of evaluating and making data-informed decisions is you know, compromised in terms of the quality and integrity and quantity of the data that we have to make decisions off of. Planning holistically. Other areas of the country have started to transition towards this, but one of them is this idea of this multimodal level of service. There is a body of research being developed that's looking at creating scores where different communities have different types of access and different. If you look, we look across the state, the transportation situation in each community isn't the same. Some depend more on air, some depend more on marine and or the highways or active transportation. So coming up, how do we gauge investment across all modes? How do we gauge access across all modes? So some of this is leading into equity. And as we're starting to dabble in the idea of a statewide equity plan in terms of transportation. Our current regulations are very out of date. And I'm specifically talking about our planning regulations, but just in general, there's this idea that in many instances, the state can be somewhat hamstrung by our own regulations because they haven't been maintained. Our planning regulations call out four categories of projects that we have to put every project into a bucket, and that's our community transportation program, our transportation alternatives program, national highways, and Alaska highways. It doesn't take into account when federal law changes and there's new eligibilities, new programs. We do have flexibility within our regulation to where the commissioner can authorize new programs to be made, but you know, part of this is trying to include as much public input in how these regulations are crafted. We've been approaching our Roads and Highways Advisory Board for active engagement, and you know, how should we be engaging with the public? How should we be incorporating input into some of these things?
Quick question there: you referred to regulations in statutes. Are there statutes driving the regulations that we need to address as well?
Chair, that's a great question. I would have to go and look at the linkages, but we could get you some of that information. Yeah.
Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I see here on bullet point number 7, you state that you have vague working definitions for these particular sections. And on previous slides, you had one that said tribes. And I'm curious if you have a statutory definition that you're applying that to, or is that also a vague one?
Great
question.
Is it
a federal one?
Yeah, great question. Through the chair, Senator Tobin. In that instance, that's the federal definition that where they're guiding certain funding sources to tribal transportation programs through the BIA or other intermediary. But when we're working within our own statutes or our own regulations, depending on which regulation you're using, the definition of rural or remote can mean very different things. Remote, as an example, in our regulations, says off the road system, but also does not have AMHS service. AMHS service can be a lot of different things, and service a couple times a year is not the same thing as daily service. So, one of the things we're looking at there is, you know, livability index to help kind of inform these classifications. You know, at the speaking point is how does it feel to live there? But there's data that can be brought, you know, access to schools, cost of living index, access to healthcare, access to, you know, Part 139 airports, certificated airports. So all these different things come together to help define, you know, what is it like to live there and what is the environment like? Again, kind of leading into our equity plan, but also these are in our regulations and in our regulations in how we select projects. So these are criteria. Having criteria that puts you in a remote category, as an example, makes you more competitive because it doesn't look at things like congestion and travel time reliability and things that you're going to find in more urban areas. The rural areas, on the other hand, within our regulations, do compete against the urban projects. But a lot of times those rural areas can't compete because they don't have the volume, they don't have the crash history, they don't have a lot of these things. So when we're looking at our criteria and more broadly our regulations, how we go about categorizing and evaluating projects, a lot of it gets to definitions.
Thank you. I just want to be sure I interjected. I'm not sure. Did you get to address slow-moving bureaucracies and processes? In other words, the rest of the slide. I don't want to overlook that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. It's an important one. So, you know, part of you know, what I did, like, you know, just in all candid, I work with Dils Andreasen from the Alaska Municipal League quite a bit. We've been partnering on a lot of initiatives, and it's been great to partner with him. I actually went through this with him before and said, does this feel right? And that was one of the areas that he says that's probably the biggest one for them. The ability for the department to move quickly can sometimes be challenged. And it's not everywhere, and it's not equal. But it is felt by communities, by our partners, the ability, the amount of time that it takes in some instances to get to a decision and who is the final decision maker can sometimes be slow. The amount of time it takes to get through processes can be a bit slow. So in that instance, you know, where the commissioner this last week said, you know, we are doers, we do. That is true when it gets to project delivery. Very often in some of those preparatory phases, planning, you know, we can spend an inordinate amount of time studying and evaluating and putting things through process. And is there an ability for us to speed some of that up? So again, this is looking at agile processes. Is there anything within these processes that do not add value from the perspective of the customer? So that's going to be a big one for us over this next year is the idea of lean, the idea of removing waste from our processes.
Well, thank you. To that point, so these are seven items have been surfaced here as current challenges. Do you feel, are they top tier? Is this an example of some challenges, or is this kind of the top list of seven at a thousand? We all have a lot of challenges that we deal with. Have these been elevated through criticality, seen by the department as key?
I would say that in a lot of the, well, certainly within planning and some of that preparatory work where we're talking about, this is some of the things that we're challenged with. There are obviously additional challenges for the department as a whole, and so there are other things, maintenance and operations, you know, our vessel fleets and things like that. So if we're looking for a singular list, this would not be the list.
But no, agreed, and thank you. I guess what I'm saying, so one of the processes by the way problems are addressed is to look at, find the critical few. You know, we've got a, you know, 1,000 line item spreadsheet, but somehow we've criticality ranked what's important. And this is within this first phase of my nickname for the thing is the snail. And so the quality snail. And so we're still in red. So that's kind of you're learning. You've identified maybe some opportunities. So with these seven, is there an active improvement project that's, speaking of projects, that's going on right now since these have been identified, that to pursue these, an identifiable project, is it on a list of critical needs, and is there resourcing and scope of work associated with correcting all of these? So we have a silo mentality versus team. I suspect that there's something going on around that. Maybe you can tell us, but tackling the slow moving bureaucracy and processes, that's a great project right there. And there's ways of working through that in a methodical progress track basis. Just wanted to know, do we have that right now?
Thank you. Excellent question, Chair Kaufman. The answer is yes, but. So on many of these, we do have either an active risk register or an active one or more projects. Not all of these. I mean, this is a very distilled down kind of punch list of items. But slow-moving bureaucracies would be probably 1,000 different projects within the department across all disciplines. I can give you a couple examples. On the silo mentality versus the team mindset, there's been a big push within the department for more teaming to include implementation of certain teaming method, agile methodologies, coming up with team charters, coming up with requirements that teams span across divisions and regions, including multidisciplinary teams. Our Deputy Commissioner, Catherine Keith, has been pretty instrumental in helping the department move forward over the last year when she came on as Change Management Director in moving the department towards this idea of teaming. Within our legacy systems and data practices, been one of the ones that's been on the forefront of my mind is this idea of being able to make good decisions. It doesn't have to be a data-driven decision, and in some cases it shouldn't be. But how do we go about making good decisions? We've engaged and have active projects with data science firms that are assisting us in evaluating our data practices. We have a data planning data summit for raising literacy and awareness within the department. We've built a data...
Raising literacy within the department? I have to pause there. Literacy in general or technical literacy?
Data literacy.
Data literacy.
Right. So just awareness of... Not just awareness of what data is out there, but how to get to it, how to use it, how to make decisions off of it. When we're looking at one model that's called the analytics maturity model, it puts an organization's use in analytics in different phases, starting with kind of descriptive, where you kind of look back and say what happened, to diagnostic that says why did it happen, predictive, what's going to happen, and prescriptive, how do we make something happen. And the department, we have some programs that are in the predictive, like our highway safety improvement program, where we have data and there's a big body of research that can say, if we do this treatment in this area, this X will happen. A lot of the department is not as advanced as our safety program. So looking at, across the board, how do we make decisions? And a big piece to that in terms of moving up the maturity model is more of the organization needs to be aware of the data and value data as an asset.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Any other questions before we move on? All right, and more about improvement projects as we go, I'm sure. So thank you. I see now we're in the planning stages, and just a time check, we're at 2:11 by the official clock, run until 3, so just heads up. All right, let's proceed.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Right, so the continuous improvement snail has put us in the planning phase. I'm going to steal that.
That's just a nickname. You don't have to use it on the record.
The planning phase is really about where are we going, what's in our trajectory, what's along our periphery that we need to account for, what types of things do we need to take into consideration. Some of this is informed by obviously what's happened. Some of this is informed by what we are anticipating to happen. So this is really getting into how we're going to go about making decisions in the near future for the coming years.
Do you wish to outline it? Is that it for this slide?
Yes, sir.
Okay, great. If we could just hang on this one a little bit. Are there any questions? Just looking at plans, so the long-range transportation plan, got some notes that it was due fall of 22, so just wondering what the current status of that plan is.
Yeah, thank you for the question, Chair. I will talk about the LRTP current status on the next slide, but just quickly, it was originally scheduled for fall. IIJA has presented quite a few changes that we had to incorporate, so we had to go back to those advisory committees. We had to add quite a few things. But where we weren't at any risk of any negative outcomes by delaying that, it is already done with final draft, or rather the public involvement wrapped in December. So we're going through final draft, and that'll be going through for approval. The freight plan, which was walking hand in hand with the LRTP, did have to get separated because it was on a shorter timeline. It needed to be approved by November, and that one's been approved.
Thank you. Just in some of the modal plans, looking at some of the dates, so I guess you have a big effort in the background to update all the modal plans as well.
Yes, that's correct. May I proceed to the next slide?
Yes, sir.
All right. So as Senator Kaufman was describing, you know, this slide describes the family of plans, and this is not a new concept for transportation, but it's a new concept for the state. The LRTP, which started its update the better part of 2 years ago, we've been going about it quite a bit more intentionally. In the past, the LRTP has been a policy document that was prepared and in order to meet the federal requirement, but there was very little direct connections into our other plans, very little connection into direct actions or a development of a work plan. So this year, or 2 years ago, when we went outset of the LRTP, it was, we need to make this actionable. So this has moved from a policy plan to what's known as a performance-based plan. This plan has objectives, it has actions in it that the state hopes to achieve. This framework that you see makes specific connections to all of the plans such that they work together, not each one kind of being produced in their own little vacuum. So part of this is creating a hierarchy to show where those plans exist and making specific connections so that when the LRTP concludes through the strategic investment plan, this is a new plan for the department and the state. And this is where we would get into some specific goals and policies and actions that would be produced out of the LRTP. You heard from the commissioner the idea of these investment areas. Those are the outcome of the LRTP and a lot of public engagement, public involvement to try to narrow that down to what are the real areas that we need to invest in and why. So all of those will trickle down into our modal and system plans, Our modal and system plans will identify objectives and things that we're trying to accomplish within, say, an AMHS long-range plan or an active transportation plan. Part of what you don't see here is with IIJA, there's a requirement for quite a few new plans that we'll be adding to our family of plans, an equity plan, a resiliency plan, a carbon reduction policy plan. So there's more planning occurring now than, I don't want to say ever before, but probably for a very long time evaluating, and this isn't all state planning. So when we're looking at things like the PROTECT program, the state has certain interests, areas that continuously get hit year over year, rockfall mitigation, coastal erosion, things like that. But part of this is putting some of these funding opportunities out to communities who have their own needs and have giving them some funds to be able to develop some of these plans. All of these things would then feed into our area plans or what we're starting to call corridor plans. We don't have corridor plans right now. We do corridor studies, but they're usually trying to answer a specific question or a specific purpose. This is really looking at an entire corridor, regardless of region, and what are all of the various things. And by the way, they don't have to be just highways. We've got freight corridors, rail. In rural Alaska, maybe it's an aviation corridor. But looking at things, you know, more holistically. The yellow bars I'll actually credit to Mr. Robert Venables, because we've been going through this a bit thoughtfully, but also inclusively. We've talked with Roads and Highways Advisory Board. We've talked with our a couple of our ARDRs and some of those folks too. How do we do this better? How do we make these plans better? And you know, as a planner within the department, you know, we just know that there's a connection. But it doesn't mean as much as if you don't do it intentionally. He's like, so when Robert look at this, he's like, there really should be an arrow coming back up. These area plans, these regional plans, these local needs should be feeding back up into the LRTP. And he's absolutely right. So part of this is that feedback loop that pulls all of those things back up. So once we're going through, those help to inform future iterations of the LRTP. The other thing about this whole cycle is we're starting to explore, again, going back to the agile way of thinking, there's an agile planning that is starting to be considered. And what that means is that planning isn't a what they call a waterfall process, where it's very linear. You have certain starts and stops, and you go through a planning process and you stop, and you've got a planning document, and you use that document. Our area plans are updated every 10 to 15 years, and a lot can change in that time, and those plans can become irrelevant pretty quickly. So one of the things that we're looking at is continuous plans. Can the LRTP be a continuous plan where we're always working to update it? Now there's going to be certain, you know, guideposts and things that we're going to want to put up where we want to maintain. We don't want to be steering the ship a different way every day, but can we be more agile in the way we're deploying and making investment decisions? So one of those continuous improvement projects is a development of a continuous LRTP. We'll have to engage with our federal partners because there are some mechanical pieces and some procurement pieces to that. But it's the way we've done it in the past isn't working anymore, and we need to be more agile.
Thank you. Kind of a quick, maybe a quick question. So at these various tiers, can you just kind of through the organization, who the plan owner at these various tiers? So in planning, so the high-level objectives flow down and the execution plans flow up, either long-range strategic or short-range execute. Can you just walk us through how this lays onto the organization, who owns these plans?
Yeah, certainly. Great question, Senator Kaufman. With the LRTP, we have a long-range transportation manager. that shepherds that, the development of that. It has been every 4 years. With IIJA, we have to do that every 4 years now. But again, if we're always updating it, then by the time the 4 year comes up, we're already ready. The strategic investment plan, it's not only a new plan, but it's a new section within the division. Over this last year, we've created a strategic investment section and a strategic investment chief. That individual is responsible for taking together all of the data that we have. So this is the person, the section, the unit, the people that are responsible for our data science contract, that are developing our data business plan, that are so this would is falling under their task list. The modal and system plans, this is where we start to diverge outside of the division. Really, we're starting to get into program management, where for our active transportation statewide plan, as an example, we have an active transportation planner that owns that plan, and he engages with not just communities but advocacy groups, with disabled and other equitable groups. We have AMHS plans, and we've got folks dedicated to those. When we get into the area plans, that's where the area planners that we have assigned. We have an area planning map that we can provide. It is also on our website, and this breaks the state up into not DOT regions, but into area regions. That's one of the maps we're evaluating in terms of, do we have the right support there in terms
that's
of
where regions and modes intersect.
Yes. So the area plans are where strategic investment, LRTP, and the modal system plans, all of these things would come together into that area plan. But the important thing there is that those area plans are not all going to, they're not all going to look the same, and two, the priorities in one area are going to be a lot different than in another area. And I've got a slide that kind of showcases that here in a little bit.
So I think we have a question from Senator Tobin.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You spoke a few moments ago about agility, and I know that the federal government continues to issue new guidance as we continue to unpack IIJA. There has been some notices of wavering of non-federal match, particularly for complete streets and some of those types of programs. How can we help you remain agile? What could the legislature do to help shift this mindset?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, maybe you could reframe the question with it. Within what context?
So knowing some of these new guidances are going to shift the requests for capital funds, they're going to shift some needs within the department. And as you mentioned, it's a slow-moving bureaucracy. Sometimes it just takes a while to get started. So how can we help? What can we do to give you the tools to be more agile, be more nimble, and be more responsive to community?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Tobin, that's a very good and probably difficult question. I mean, there's a lot of what we've been doing in the department, over the last year, has been how do we work more with our partners, with communities? How do we put community first? Anytime we look at these teeny models, it's a circle within a series of circles, and the community is at the middle. When it comes to assistance, it's probably give a more thoughtful answer and have some time, because there's probably a short list that with the commissioner's office we could come up with where the legislature could be really impactful.
If we could take that as an action, just time check. We're halfway through the slide pack, and We've only got about 30 odd minutes with a little time to close. So it's a lot of dense information. So I don't think that's a flaw of the process. It's just, it is what it is. So maybe we can run through these more quickly, or maybe we'll have to come back for second bite of the apple, whichever. So let's roll. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator. So this is one of the products of the long range transportation plan, and this is we put several surveys out. This survey had 2,700 responses, and this got into by region, and these are not any region you'll see on DOT materials. This was like groupings of prioritization. So different areas of the state prioritize different things. So we started to, with the LRTP team, started to draw this map, and some consistent trends emerged from certain areas. The point of this slide is this can help to inform, as we're getting into our modal and system plans and our area plans, where we're starting from. We're not always reinventing things, but this isn't necessarily saying we're going to have a prescription of what that area plan looks like, meaning just because we have 2,700 responses in the Southeast that prioritize mobility, operations, and sustainability means that that's what we're locked into. But that helps us to give us a baseline for further questions and refinement. And to the previous family of plan slides, that feedback loop, well, is this right? If not, why? One of the things you'll notice on here is that there's no YK Delta, because this was an open solicitation where we gathered input, but we got no feedback from the YK Delta area. We presented this to the Roads and Highways Advisory Board, and Mr. Andrew Guy, said, maybe that's just a symptom of just DOT not being out there, and maybe there should be some priority given to just having nothing. And that was pretty powerful. And we're also seeing that, to Mr. Guy's point, we're also seeing that as IIJA is delivered, we're seeing our discretionary grant applications be denied because the level of public involvement that's defined in our public involvement plan is no longer sufficient. Meaning we need to be actively getting out into these communities, actively outreaching, not just posting something on Gov Delivery and OPN and saying we're doing a thing. It's getting on the phone and talking to the community planner, the city manager, and saying we want your input. So being more active in our outreach and in our coordination with our communities is going to be important as we continue down this development of our family of plans.
Question? Senator Myers?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I guess less a question, more of a comment, but I'd be curious to hear your reaction to it. I'm noticing we have economic vitality here, and out of the five regions that you did receive responses from, only one of them put it as one of their priorities. Well, around this building, we talk a lot about our capital projects and infrastructure as part of how we grow and strengthen our economy. And then if we go back to, it's just part of this slide from the last presentation, just kind of quoting what DOT does. It says, contributing to the development of commerce and industry in the state. And to me, that just seems like kind of a disconnect, whether it's between, us and the department, or the department and the people, or us and the people. It's just a very it's such a large disconnect. It's hard for me to ignore.
Yeah. Through the chair, Senator Myers, it's an excellent question and not one that's lost on us. This is not necessarily the position of the department. These are the responses from what we received and from our public input. So there was a survey put out where we received input from the public, because you're absolutely right. In the Southeast and in many other areas, we expect that economy and economic vitality would make the top of the list. That's where getting more intentional about who we're asking and when is important. It can't be just the same old way of doing public input. So it's an excellent point. Yep.
All right. Percy?
So I won't spend a lot of time on this slide. You all have seen this, and I shamelessly recycled it, only within the context of these areas are not just investment areas. So one of the big tasks, the things that's going to come out of the LRTP, the commissioner's been pretty explicit, is a dashboard. It's really a matrix of investment area by mode, and we're thinking, you know, by land, by sea, by air. Okay, we've got a target for safety for the state. How is AMHS contributing to that target? What's the measure? What's the baseline? What's the goal? So for all of these, it's done within the idea of objectives and key results. So this is trying to, you know, that which is measured is improved, right? So I just wanted to use this as a talking point, just because that's going to be a pretty big task. We have our federal performance measures, and we already have that dashboard that's out there. So you can see pavement condition, bridge condition, travel time reliability, those things. We don't have great metrics on economic vitality and how the systems and the projects and the things that we're investing in are improving that. So it's doing it within the lens of outcomes. And that's one of the things that, you know, we're kind of grappling with, because a lot of the investments that we're making take so long to see the products of. 7, 8, 10 years to look back, all right, we made a decision for this reason. Was it the right? Did it have the outcome we expect? And then adjust. So this is only within the context of kind of what's coming next, what we're planning for.
Thank you. In the value equation, where I grew up, they had farm-to-market roads. Now, that was pretty clear. you were moving produce and getting it to the point of consumption. So that clarity is always great. Thank you. Let's proceed.
So the next section, we're going to talk about deployment. And this is really getting into, what the commissioner said. We're doers. So we've identified some of this stuff pretty early on with IIJA. We knew that there was more capacity needed than what was available within the department or even the state. We knew that partnerships were going to be critically important. We knew that distributed planning was going to be critically important. Leveraging our consultant partners and contractors more than we ever have been was going to be critically important. So this next couple slides are really going to talk about is what we have been doing and what is currently on the books. So Senator Kaufman, to your point, these are some of the active projects or initiatives that we're engaging in to get to where we want to be.
Any questions? Let's proceed.
So in addition to our family of plans, we're creating this, what we call our family of programs. And I won't read through all of these, but this kind of gives you a sense of what some of the new is. We have, as I mentioned, our community transportation program and our transportation alternatives program already. Those are there and they're great. We also have state-run programs that are more data-driven, like our highway safety improvement program, our bridges, our culverts. Some of the new programs, Safer Ice Roads for Alaskans, is one that are actively engaged in. Coming up over this next quarter, you'll see solicitations for rural ports, docks, and barge landings. We've never been able to engage in that type of work before. It is a new eligibility, not necessarily a new federal program, but just a new eligibility. The Community Bridge Program, to Senator Meyer's point, was, you know, that's how we're funneling some of those funds into a program. And by the way, that can, for local community bridges, has no match requirement federally, which is great. Sustainable transportation program that gets into all of the green that is in IIJA. One of the things, the challenges with rolling this out is, some of IIJA came to the state in individual discrete programs or tranches of funding. Some of it came through sprinkled across a lot of programs. times. So we saw a lot of electrification, a lot of EV, a lot of carbon reduction, greenhouse gas, but in a lot of different programs. So this program is knitting those all together into a single strategy, a single plan. So there will be a sustainable transportation plan that will be developed. We're working, we have an MOA with the Alaska Energy Authority, and we're working with them on the NEVI plan, the National Electric Vehicle Infrastructure Plan, which would be part of, you know, that overall strategy. In addition to those solicitations, where we're going to be going out and providing funding opportunities for communities, there's going to be some additional state programs. So the Carbon Reduction Program, which is some of the same funding you would see in the Sustainable Transportation Program, but would be for like state infrastructure. So that's within our next STIP amendment. If you take a look at those, you'll see a statewide LED program. So you know, this idea of light up Alaska. We can do more with some of these things that we haven't been able to do before. Putting, you know, potentially electric charging stations at the internationals to bookend the corridors, as an example. So these are all things that we're looking at. So that just this CRP just represents the state side of those funds. And then there's the promoting resilient operations and transformative, efficient, and cost-saving transportation. So this is resiliency, and this is on this specific piece, this is state assets. We are evaluating, you know, can we provide some of this funding to communities, but it is kind of a deliberative process. There's been a lot's changed just in the last 6 months between the West Coast Alaska storm, Typhoon Murbach, and all the needs out there, and can these funds be used to leverage to improve things out there. One of the nice things about the PROTECT program is it has more flexibility than some of our standard programs, where they don't have to be surface transportation facilities. It could be at-risk coastal communities. It could be evacuation routes. It could be armoring of coastal infrastructure, or looking at coastal erosion and things. So that particular program is still going through kind of an evaluation.
Questions? Let's proceed.
So a little bit of information on the Safe Ice Roads for Alaskans. We have gone through our solicitation. We have issued awards. Right now, the awards have been pretty modest. It's only $2 million. But these $2 million are going to go a long way in some of these communities. The Native Village of Napaimute received $450,000, so that's most of the Kuskokwim River. Tanana Tribal Council received $32,000. Crooked Creek received $30,000. So this gives you a sense of some of these things. In general, FHWA is still kind of grappling with what this means. In IIJA, it was a one-sentence thing. So how do they deploy that? Early indications are that they may be getting more restrictive than the language of the law, and that could potentially play out in what we're able to fund in terms of eligible activities. As recent as today, we're hearing some of this. So that may be one of the challenges that we're looking at. But this year was definitely a baseline year. It was an evaluation of what we expect the needs to be to come in. So as we're looking forward to future capital budget cycles, it was, you know, there could be certainly be an evaluation of, does this program need to be increased? The challenge with this and some of these other programs, where it's not a new program federally, it's just a new eligibility, is they all come out of STBG, our Surface Transportation Block Grant. So that's the program that is about the second bar earlier on, that was about 27%. So that's one of our most flexible pots of funds, but it goes to a lot of things. That's the sole fund source for our community transportation program, for our Alaska highways, for ice roads, and in some of these other instances, we're able to do rural and local maintenance. So we're able to supplement, you know, some of our winter activities with it. So it's a limited pot of funds, but, you know, it can do a lot of good.
Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So apart from this you know, relatively new program, it's kind of my understanding that a lot of these ice roads, they're longstanding. You build them every winter, and been going on for a while. My question is, if we're going to spend the money to continue building the ice road every winter and, you know, have to obviously start fresh every time around, at what point does the department start looking at planning and saying, all right, we're going to start building, we're going to consider building a permanent road? I mean, if you're going to continue building the ice roads, obviously the demand is there for the traffic. At what point do we start actually saving money by having a permanent road and maintaining that rather than building a new ice road every year?
Good question through the chair, Senator Myers. In a lot of instances, particularly in these the higher dollar ones, the ice road is on a river, so there's limited capacity. But in some instances, maybe there's an economy of scale for building a facility that is as opposed to just maintenance. So a lot of this activity is it's plowing, it's setting, it's doing ice core drilling for thickness and setting up road markers and safety and all of that. But that would certainly be, you know, one of those future kind of considerations if we're continuously building over and over. And that, by the way, is one of the criteria is a community's ability and demonstrated ability to build and maintain these. You know, they get extra points that they already have the infrastructure and the skills and the ice road already exists.
Time check, we got about 3 minutes per remaining slide, so we'll have to step on the gas a little bit on our proverbial road. So please proceed.
Community Bridge Program, this is a solicitation that you will see coming up within the next quarter, where we've got some good opportunities, particularly for local and rural, what they call off-system bridges, where there is no match requirement. The state is going to use some of these funds, not from this amount you see here, this $54 million, but from that bridge investment program to take care of our own infrastructure. But we recognize that we're also not the only ones out there. But finding the right partners, finding the right mix, because it's not just off of performance or condition. Sometimes it is a reasonable detour length, and in a lot of instances, there is no detour, or it's hundreds of miles away. So criticality, connection to important resources, these are all things that are being developed with our data science firm to try to make this not just a what's the condition, but what is the impact to lives? So we will be seeing this one come through. And you know, one of the nice things about this is that, well, aside from the match piece, is that it's anything on the National Bridge Inventory. So that can include things like, you know, large culverts and in some instances some ferry docks are on the NBI. So there's some flexibility that we've got there in deploying this.
All right, let's proceed.
Another one that we're pretty excited about is the Rural Ports, Docks, and Barge Landings. So this is not a new federal program. This is, again, a new eligibility within the Surface Transportation Program to be able to provide funding for just that, rural ports, docks, and barge landings. When we were talking with federal partners, I mean, a lot of this is really getting to most coastal infrastructure could be supported through this. But again, this is one of these things where you have a finite amount of funds, and how much is going to go to ice roads, and how much is going to go to CTP, how much is going to go to rural ports, docks, and barge landings. And that is an important point because we as we're developing the strategic investment plan, which would start to, you know, put pencil to paper in terms of how these distributions are made, we want to include a lot of input. So these numbers weren't, you know, necessarily developed in a vacuum. We took a lot of these and went to Roads and Highways Advisory Board. We went to the Alaska Marine Highways Operations Board, and, you know, some of the other partners and solicited input. Like, how do you see this program being distributed? Is it state use? Is it a solicitation? Is it a new thing? So we've solicited, you know, some input to try to get these, but, you know, time is always our enemy. So we wanted to try to get it out there quickly. Strategic investment plan would be, you know, how do we do that more? So that would be the more methodical approach where we gain lots of input, but that would where we would start to pencil in distributions, funding, where everything's going. The important one takeaway with this program is the eligibility federally is specific to rural, and they're defining that as on the road system. We are not using that the state definition, what I mentioned earlier about the AMHS connectivity, so that with some of our community, a lot of our communities would be eligible, but certain communities that are on the road system, like Homer or Seward or others, would not be eligible for this program.
Yes, Senator Tobin.
So you mentioned you're getting a lot of feedback, and one of the things that I know from some of the other departments that I've heard testimony from is that IT limitations are really becoming significant barriers to community outreach. Is DOT experiencing something similar? Is there archaic technologies or systems that are preventing you from reaching out to more Alaskans?
Through the chair, Senator Tobin, excellent question and timely. Yes. You know, the tools at our disposal have historically largely been, you know, online public notice and gov delivery. And as we saw before, while could be extensive, we received 2,700 comments. It might be just the loud minority that's showing up or a disproportionate share. So being more active in how we're getting that. So to your point, we are exploring a new tool called, I'm gonna mess this up. I think it's called Public Comment, where it's this active online tool where we can put things out, we can put it to a lot of different boards, and it helps to streamline our public comment process. There is also the human side of it where we just need to be more active in outreaching to people. If we haven't heard from anybody in the YK Delta, we should be calling Bethel, we should be calling the Pioneer, we should call into Buskiak. So there's two pieces. There is the technical side, which we are working to address through a series of pilots, and there's the human side. Yeah.
Thank you. Let's proceed.
So strategic partners, again, from the outset, it's been we can't do this on our own. We're extremely capacity limited in our ability to get out to communities because it's everything all at once with this. And there's this, this big, what they're calling FOMO or fear of missing out is how do we engage with more? Alaska Municipal League has been an incredible partner because they already have a lot of these connections established. We've been working really closely with a lot of our ARDRs. Are the ARDRs a natural vehicle for our, some of these things like regional planning organizations? We got MOAs with the Alaska Energy Authority, and we're in some instances transferring funds to the Denali Commission because as funds get transferred to them, a lot of the Title 23 requirements aren't as required. So they've got more flexibility in some instances. Now they're still federal, so they still have OMB and OIG rules. Looking at all of these kind of creatively, even our federal partners, when we're looking at bringing more resources to bear, we've got a project. Maybe it gives us access to a federal trail, and maybe it's a truck pull out, and maybe it gives us recreation opportunities. So blending funds and bringing more people into the evaluation process when we're going through these projects is a pretty exciting development.
Let's proceed.
So I did want to start to kind of wrap up with, you know, this idea of community-driven planning. This is something we've been working towards over the past couple years. The last year's legislature gave us some intent language, which was apropos because we were already kind of heading down this path, so the timing was right. What you see on this map, which is a little bit, has been updated since the last map you saw, the green boxes represent areas that have signed. So, you know, we just recently signed with Fairbanks North Star Borough. The Northwest Arctic Borough is set to be signing here soon. All the orange areas, Prince William Sound, Kenai Peninsula, and Southeast, we've spoken with all of those ARDRs, which all have expressed interest in potentially exploring you know, what does an RPO look like in our area. The nexus there is that, you know, perhaps there's a stronger relationship to, say, our area plans or our region plans. You know, those planning efforts have historically been kind of DOT-led planning efforts. The Southeast plan involves a lot of people. Maybe if there's an RPO in the area, they could take a stronger role or stronger position, or maybe co-lead the plan development with us. The purple areas there represent areas where we have not received you know, explicit outreach. We did receive outreach from Bristol Bay. I am trying to get time with Swansea and the Norton Sound area. And then there's the, you know, the question of, you know, what about everything else? And then, you know, in that area, we've been talking with AML. And, you know, is there an opportunity there to partner with them where they could potentially serve as, you know, a technical advisory committee for all these areas, or provides a resource for all these areas to kind of get engaged in that? This voice of the customer section is Jen Rosenthal. So she's from Copper Valley. And she said, it's tough being the first, but DOT staff are helping us and we are figuring it out together. The biggest takeaway is not to rush in, have your policies and procedures in place. So this was one of the big, you know, kind of learning moments, because while there's a desire to want to jump in and do these things because it's very new, it's very exciting, there's a lot of opportunity for local planning, local prioritization. But the Fairbanks North Star Borough, before, you know, the FAST MPO planning was created, they were working for years to develop their policies, their bylaws, their structures, their institutions. And then they got their designation. The same could be said for, you know, the upcoming Matsu MPO. We've been providing them funding for the better part of 2 years to start to go through those early development before designation. So what Jen was getting at, or part of what her comment went on to say, was go at your own pace. Don't rush it. Have your policies and things lined up. So that was an important takeaway. As exciting as this is, it still benefits, because they're having to go back and do that retrospectively.
Let's proceed. Thank you.
With the discretionary grants, you know, there's so much opportunity. And as I kind of showed you in one of those earlier slides, a lot of opportunity for direct recipients. So individual communities, in some cases nonprofits and advocacy groups, can now apply for these things. But how do we, you know, one of the things we've been saying from the beginning is we want to compete collectively against the lower 48, not against each other. And so in a lot of instances, that means the state is not the one that is applying for these. But how do we get communities and, you know, potential project sponsors to want to come to the table to work with us to find either efficiencies, to where we could provide resources? So very early on, you know, we partnered with AML. We have an MOA in place where we're working this problem together. What you see here is one of the products of that partnership. We developed a project intake clearinghouse, which actually is called the Alaska Federal Opportunities Funding Hub. It's a very long acronym. But basically, it creates a central space for communities. Maybe they have a project, but they don't necessarily know all the different, you know, acronyms and opportunities that are out there in the alphabet soup world of discretionary grants. But they have a need. They can submit their projects on here, and they work with AML staff, work with DOT staff, and connect their needs to projects. Maybe they don't have resources, and we can connect them with engineering firms that, you know, will supply funding for, or connect them with the grant writers, which AML or we could supply funding for. So this is really creating this kind of central repository where we can bring all of our resources to bear to where Alaska is competitive, not DOT is competitive. What you'll find in a lot of our awards that we've received so far, it's been in the instance where, you know, we've got a project idea or we've been working with a community that has a project idea, but we say you need to go be first on this. We've gotten we've been awarded a planning grant for the Kodiak Russian bridges. There's two bridges and we put Kodiak on front of that. I mean, these are DOT planning environmental linkage studies, but we're doing it in partnership with Kodiak. We've been awarded in the Prince William Sound, the Tetitlik, Chiniga, and Cordova bundle of projects. Prince William Sound Economic Development was primary on that. So this is, you know, one of these ideas of pulling all of our resources together and trying to be as strategic as possible and not necessarily needing to, you know, control all the shiny things, but how do we make Alaskan infrastructure better?
And acting as an on-ramp. I'm sorry, I just had to slip that in. So we're running short on time. We need to save a little for closing comments. Are there any last questions or comments from the committee? No? All right. And so if I can find literally the get on the right page here. And so no further questions, comments. I want to thank everyone who graced this room in presenting, and the committee, and particularly the staff that helps us pull all this off. It's much appreciated. Our next regularly scheduled meeting will be this coming Thursday, Friday the 2nd, 2023, 1:30 p.m., where we will be hearing a presentation from DOT, now that's a surprise, and the Alaska Marine Highway Operations Board about the Alaska Marine Highway System. That's sure to be an interesting hearing. And again, no closing comments or thoughts, so I'll say our meeting is now adjourned at 2:58 p.m. We brought it in ahead of schedule.